Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 7, delivered on September 8, 2009. The title of this lecture is Essentials of Accounting.
Today, Essentials of Accounting. Now, accounting is not finance. We use accounting information. We would say that the accountant's job ends right where ours begins, except that accountants sometimes sell themselves as financial analysts, and businesses believe that an accountant is eminently best qualified to do financial analysis, and I am here to tell you no. We have people called finance who get degrees in finance who can do the financial analysis. And for you, whether you're going to major in finance or not, most of you are going to be bright enough that you can do investment decision making on your own. And that means being able to look at the financial statements of companies and get a good feel for yourself. You will find out that it is more nuanced than what you might read in some financial newspaper or hear some financial talking head say on television. The study of financial statements is actually, you can get as deep as you want. You can get into very intellectual conversations. I don't want to go that far, but I do want you to understand the essentials of how you look at financial statements and why we need to understand how financial statements are constructed so that we can usefully analyze them. I am certainly not going to teach you about how to do debits and credits and trial balances. I physically can't bring myself to do that. That's not what we want to do anyway. That's what the accountants do. The accountants do the debits and the credits, the trial balances, and they create the financial statements. And then we in the finance field take over and say, now let's look at what has been produced. I do need to know how it was produced, but that's secondary to what it is that I do, which is to analyze these statements, rearrange them as necessary, take them apart in certain ways to get what I can out of them. The textbook and most textbooks that I've ever taught, from which I've ever taught, will tell you that there are three financial statements. There is the income statement. There is the balance sheet, and there is the statement of cash flows, or the sources and uses statement. Sometimes I've heard it called. Here's the deal. And even when I taught accounting, and I did teach accounting, I needed the money. There were a couple things that I said that were a little different, and I've got to make a correction right here. On my own, as a professor of finance, I can say as I need to say what it is I need to say about accounting. The income statement is nothing but a sidebar calculation in the balance sheet. The income statement is nothing but a great big nodule on the side of the balance sheet down in the owner's equity section. It really is, because what it is that comes out of the income statement, the purpose of the income statement, to generate the net income line and then the dividends line, those feed to the balance sheet. Hence, everything that you are calculating in an income statement is to the purpose of generating two numbers for the balance sheet. They are, in fact, then income statements, simply sidebar calculations of a balance sheet. And you'll hear me sometimes treat them very much that way. The statement of cash flows is our biggie in finance. The statement of cash flows is our biggie in finance. Because you see, we do not care much about net income of a company. The reason is because net income is the result of calculations on things that didn't cost the company a thing, and the result of calculations of things the company sold that brought it no money. Here's the thing. Money is not going to buy you happiness, but it is a damn good substitute until you find out what does. Okay? Cash is what we care about. Liquidity. If a company drills itself into a crater with respect to the money that it has to pay its bills, the creditors will come in. That's their rational incentive. If you can't pay your bills, you can be the wealthiest corporation on earth, but if you can't pay your bills, the court will hear from the creditors. Yes, creditors, we understand. You had the prior claim. They have not satisfied this prior claim. Therefore, the corporation then must step up to the plate and answer to the bar of justice. That's the reality of it. So in finance, our chief concern is with the cash flow of the company. Can the company pay its bills? Literally and physically, can it cover its ass? So that's why the statement of cash flows is most important to us, because the financial statements do not, the income statement and the balance sheet, they have items on there that never create, that are not creating cash. Just because you tell me you had $1 million in sales doesn't mean that you have $1 million in cash. A lot of that could have been receivables. Receivables are great, but they don't pay your bills. You might have to sell your receivables at some kind of a real serious discount just to have some cash. I've seen companies do that. They had receivables out the butt, and they ended up having to sell. They didn't have any cash, literally, to pay their bills. They ended up having to sell their receivables at pennies on the dollar just so they had the money to pay their bills for the month. Saw that, a very good example of that once as a consultant. It hurt like hell. The company eventually died because its accounts receivable were not being collected properly. But here's the other thing. Those three financial statements right there, they are not the end of the story. They are not the end of the story. There is a fourth document that is hugely important. And there's no criticism of this textbook. Virtually every textbook from which I've ever taught left this one out. It's the notes to the financial statement. The notes to the financial statement. The notes to the financial statements tell you stories that cannot be conveyed by pure line-by-line numerical representations. In fact, if you read carefully notes to financial statements, sometimes the preparers are trying to tell you things. I can tell you that for a fact because I prepared financial statements. And when I wrote the notes of the financial statements, I was trying to flag the investors in the company. Hey, here's an issue. See all that common stock that's on the balance sheet and see how it changed? That was the owners pulling a trick called an S-8 registration statement, where they don't even have to register a physical use a physical document. They can just do a trick offshore and then bring the stock back onshore, and they avoid all paper registration. Warnings, explanations, reasoning, they're all there in those notes. Things that can't be said in numbers. Sometimes things that you wouldn't want to be said. I made disclosures in that S8 example. I prepared financial statements. The accountant who was doing the audit, he said, "You sure you want to say?" It was something like, "You sure you want to say this in the notes?" I said, "Yes," and he said, "Good." Just to make a fair disclosure, a reasonable thing that investors should know that the numbers just didn't convey properly. So the notes to the financial statement, we will look at financial statements in this class. We'll just open them up and start the process of going through them and just looking at them. honest to God, yeah, I teach you quantitative stuff in this class, but really, at the end of the day, use sense, gut. Let that whisper come out. Wait, this is a little odd how this has been moving over the past few years. Oh, let me look at this liquidity ratio. Yeah, that's okay. And sometimes, let me try this. Suppose you have a company, you've been looking at its cash flows, statements of cash flow. It's been accumulating cash year over year. See, sometimes you'll see a company that is accumulating cash. Cash is going up. It is what we would say it's spinning off cash from its operations. And other companies are absorbing cash. They're using more than they're bringing in. And that happens. Companies go both ways. Ideally, you sure as hell don't want to see a company absorbing cash year over year over year until it's out of business. It's in default. However, suppose you see a company that's just building its cash reserves year over year over year, just spinning off cash, spend cash, spend cash, spend cash, and its cash is just growing, growing, growing. That's what you would really want to see, right? In fact, that's not what you want to see at all. You really would worry about that. Can you tell me why?
Some maybe like legal activity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Well, I mean, there could be illegal activity. I support free enterprise, but we don't have to go that far. Why would I be bothered by a company that was spinning off cash, building cash, 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 cash every year, more and more and more and more? Always a great idea? Not really. And why? Help me out here. And it's okay if you're stumbling here. This is what this is about. Talk to me. Oh, you got an answer?
They're not investing in the company.
Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Yes! Beautiful. Give him a cookie, for God's sake. Yes! You see? Really? You got all this cash and you can't think of something to do with it? Well, give it to the investors. Maybe they can figure out something. You're building cash. You're building cash. Come on. You're a company. Can't you find any project? Hell, you wouldn't even have to use debt to finance it. You've got all this cash that's building, and your management can't figure out some way that your company can create value from that cash. Remember, the cash is not the value. It is what that cash could do for you that is going to be the value. I could give you $100,000. And I would bet you my bottom dollar 5 years from now, you'll be waiting for your next paycheck. You see, that's the reality of it. We want, most people, most companies don't know what to do with money. I want to see companies that know just what to do with their money. They don't want to build it up and hold it, well, someday it'll be bad out there. Yes, keep cash for a rainy day. Do that. But at the same time, also, use that money for something that is going to give, that is going to create value for your shareholders. So it is not as simple as, well, always plus is good, always minus is bad, always up is good, always down is bad. It's not that simple. The ratios that we'll do in next week in ratio analysis, it's not the bigger the better or the smaller the better. It's within the range is good. When it deviates too much from the range or when there's too much volatility, that's when it's bad. So it's a nuanced approach that we do in finance. It's not simplistic at all. But at first, it'll be fine. Just do the ratios, look at them. Later, I'm going to invite you to start thinking about what you're seeing. Seeing the details, that going too far either way is bad, and sometimes just going wildly around is bad too. Look, the Edgar filing system is the means by which public companies in the United States, companies with registered securities, disclose details as required by the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The Securities and Exchange Commission is pretty tough in terms of requiring that disclosures not be misleading. However, take note of this. A filing with the SEC that is posted on EDGAR or wherever by the SEC is not approved by the SEC. The SEC does not approve filings. It does not approve stock offerings. It qualifies them, provided they meet the standards that are set forth in the regulations promulgated pursuant to the laws of the Securities Act of 33 and the Securities Exchange Act of 34. In other words, in plain English, they're not going to stick their asses out on the line and say this is a good investment. They're just going to say it meets the law. That's all they're going to say. It then becomes incumbent upon the investors, the analysts, and the other interested consumers of the information products to determine what those products are saying and whether the investments that might come from the that be related to those investment those information products is worthwhile. Here we go. Look, when a company goes public, there are a couple of different there are more than a few ways to do it. The classic IPO, the initial public offering, the opus, we are a public company, would be when a company, a big company, financially strong enough, would sell its first round of common stock, possibly some other security. You can have warrants and possibly other things, but classic is selling a big pile of common stock. The company makes a filing called a registration statement. The prospectus is a part of the registration statement, but it's not the whole registration statement. The big 800-pound gorilla of the registration statements is the Form S-1. I did one Form S-1 in my life. It was back before it was illegal for non-attorneys to do S-1s, to do registration statements. Now I'd be some hard-timer's old lady at a federal facility for doing what I used to do for a living. But a Form S-1 is the big dog of the registration statements. I did one in my life. When you make this filing with the SEC, you are essentially, you have to meet all of the guidelines, bam, 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 bam. No matter how good you are, you're going to get a deficiency letter. It actually came back in my time as a fax. You screwed this up. You didn't do this. This sucks. We don't understand this. The SEC's examiners looking at the corporate, looking at it, going through it. When I did the S-1 registration statement, my first deficiency fax, I think it was 437 deficiencies. I nearly defecated. I called this old consultant who'd helped me before. I was blubbering. I'm out of fax paper, man. He said, how many did you get? Over 400. How many? 430-some. Not bad. What? You just go back. You clean up the deficiencies line by line. Submit it again. I had fewer than 20 on the second round. Third round, I submitted. It got qualified, and that's what it is. It's qualified. The SEC isn't saying, we approve of this now. They just say, okay, you can sell your stock now, after a certain period, a quiet period and all that. But that's the classic, the big 800-pound gorilla. Now, there are some other ones that I did more of these, like the Form SB one. That's a small business offering. And then there's an SB2, and there are a couple of other animals. I mentioned an S8, which is a dog that should be shot. And the shelf registration, stuff like that. And then there are, you can sell stock, but not as a public company. It would be restricted stock. It couldn't be listed. It couldn't just be sold on an exchange. Matter of fact, you probably couldn't sell it, just sell it to anyone. But you have to meet certain criteria, and you can sell stock in private offerings and exemptions. You can also give stock to a bunch of people. You could do that. It just wouldn't be freely tradable. So a lot of companies are out there that have stock outstanding. It's just that the stock can't be traded on an open, freely tradable basis. It can't be offered in the newspaper. It can't be, there's no exchange that would list it. Now, in a case like that, and the reason I bring this one up is because this is the source from which some other more general forms come, is if you are registering securities that are already in existence or otherwise seeking qualification by the SEC to be a public company in the absence of a public offering that is happening at that time or that you are intending to happen soon after, with respect to the registration statement, you would file what's called a Form 10. It is essentially becoming a public company. We have stock outstanding. This is the stock that we have outstanding that we want to register now. These are the reasons that we meet the qualifications to be a public company in the United States and for our stock to be traded by an exchange that would be interested in us, like the NASD, the OTC on a 15C211. But this Form 10 is like the opus without the gunfire. Here we are, SEC. This is what we are. These are our financial statements, audited and everything. This is the common stock we have outstanding. This is the stock that we would like now for you to view as registered stock. So this would be your beginning. Either a Form 10 or an S1, SB1, something like that. That would be your opening. From any of these would then come the requirements of securities law to periodically apprise the public through standardized filings of what you do, how you're doing, who you are, who's your board of directors, what are your financial statements, are they audited, they better be, and all of this kind of stuff. So after the registration statement, and I use this term, it's kind of a fun, it's, some people think it's a little odd. Essentially, like if you're doing a Form 10, every time you file one of these requirements, it's sort of like an amendment to your initial filing. So every year, you're amending your initial filing by saying, oh, we are now this. Every quarter, you're essentially amending your initial filing. Oh, this is an interim statement. These filings that occur on a periodic basis by law, by securities law, are the K's and Q's. There is Form 10-K, which is an annual statement that discloses essentially the update of a Form 10. Your financial statements, audited, and all kinds of other information about the company in the Form 10-K. And I made bread and butter money doing the Edgar filings for the Form 10-Ks. So every year you're filing a K. And then every quarter, you're also filing a Form 10-Q. Now, the caution is be careful with 10-Qs because they're interim statements. They're subject to a change, and they are volatile. To be honest with you, well, I shouldn't say this. In my end of the business, the Qs were put together very fast. It's just like every time you turn around, you were having to do another filing. And the Qs is just like, geez, we got another Q coming up. Didn't we just do one? Yes, 3 months ago. Oh, God. You get the Qs done, and then those compile, those four, and culminate in the year's 10-K, where you get the annual statements and all that kind of stuff in there. These are the meat and potatoes for investors, for analysts, looking at a company, looking at its financial condition, looking at the company even more deeply, you can find a lot of information in here. I caution, when you go into Edgar, you'll just see this, say you type in a company's stock symbol, and it'll come back, and just this string of documents you'll see. Different letters, different names, different numbers, and sometimes you actually have to look, where the hell is the 10-K? I don't see the, oh, there it is, thank God. Be careful, because if you find the latest 10-K, make sure that you don't see after that a 10-K-A. That would be where a K had a subsequent amendment because of an error, because of an additional something that the company wanted to let the public to know, or because the SEC bitched about something. So always be cautious when you're looking at the K's and Q's in Edgar. I fell into this. The reason I'm bringing this up is it was a couple of years ago. I fell into it. I nailed the K. There was just like these numbers. I didn't even recognize some of the forms that were being filed. And finally, I found, and what was even worse was the Edgar system now, it'll list the parts of the K separately, or the parts of a Q. Each of the subcategories, well, within the K, there are all these different parts. And it just drove me crazy. I found the K, I did some analysis. Only later did I go back and just accidentally notice that there was a KA that carried some information that was changed from the analysis numbers that I had used. So be careful. Watch for the KAs. Now, I'm going to take these two. Now, before I go any further, you were all taught about the Ks and Qs, right? Some of you are nodding. Some of you are shaking your heads. Okay, just straight up. You were taught to look at K's and Q's. Some of you are saying yes, some of you are saying no, which is what I have come to understand is that there was a variability in the knowledge here. And I got to watch myself on that. Let me show you another one. The K's and Q's are the classics, and they bring them up in the textbook. And I'm going to revisit the K's and Q's here for just K's in just a minute. But I want to bring up another form that is not mentioned. This was one, and the reason that I know about this so intimately is because I actually sort of lived on this form. It's called the 8K. It is a filing that a company has to do whenever there is a non-recurring, unusual event. It's just simply a form that says, oh, this happened. It could be one of the directors was killed. Oh, 8K gets filed. The treasurer of the company was killed in an accident. But it could also be, in my case, I did these little companies that were constantly putting out these stupid-ass press releases, trying to pump up their company's stock. There are these companies out there, yeah, we do press releases. We'll spread it to every major news service in the world. Literally, they would do this kind of crap. And my clients were such suckers. Oh, wow, so let's pump out press releases every week. This week, the president had a great idea for a new product. And now this week, the president has gone and talked to a couple of friends about his new stupid stuff. It got ludicrous in some cases. Press releases. 8K. Press release, 8K. So I just charged him $50 to do the filing in Edgar. And it was basically, I already had the template. I just cut and paste the press release in between the header tags for opening and closing tags for the text of the press release, and then just punch a button, and I had $50 in my pocket, as long as the company paid, which it didn't sometimes. But the 8Ks are useful. Don't ignore these, because a lot of times it's just like, why did they file an 8K for this? This is minor. But every now and then, you can find the 8Ks are telling things that are rather interesting. Like, for example, if a director of a company is killed in a car accident, my first reaction would be, gee, I should send flowers, but I don't know the dude, so I won't. The second thing I think is, who was he? Was he important, or was he one of those fluff directors you see all the time on boards? If he's fluff, who cares? Oh, this guy had been there for on the board for 15 years. He knew everybody. He seems to have been behind a lot of the things that the moving and shaking that this company did. That's a bad thing. That's what a financial analyst, a real solid one, would do. It has nothing whatsoever to do with numbers. It has to do with looking at statements and thinking about the consequences of what's being declared or disclosed in the statement. That's an 8K. Okay? So don't just look at the numbers, for God's sake. That's not what a good analyst does. Look at the other filings, too. And sometimes it doesn't hurt to just call a company up. Act like a dumbass. I saw this 8K. I don't understand. What was going on here? Find someone who's just kind of a lower person and see what they have to say. Don't call the big people. They don't know shit. Look. Let me go back to the K, the 10K. Yeah, the 10K has the financial statements, the income statements, balance sheet statement of cash flows, notes of the financial statement. But it doesn't stop there. The most important section of a of one of these documents, aside from the financial statements, and in some ways perhaps more important, is this, the MD&A. Now let me see if you really know what this is about. What's an MD&A? Never heard of it? Mogan, David, and Anastas. No. What's an MD&A? Do you know? That's okay. Is there anyone who does know what an MD&A is? Okay, that's cool. That's cool. MD&A is Management Discussion and Analysis. Management Discussion and Analysis. The SEC requires that the company actually turn inward and look at its own financial statements and operations and comment on them. An extensive narrative of the company looking at itself. Now that you think, well, that's kind of like they're just going to blow smoke up my ass. Well, yeah, they might. But you would be surprised at how often you can read nuance. Not necessarily bad news, but things in an MD&A. Well, the liquidity ratios rose, and if you will notice this part of the financial statements, you will notice that the liquidity ratios had been rising for several years, and in the last year they declined. They are actually trying to telegraph you, look at what we have done. This is an issue that is of concern to us. Yes, you're not crazy if you see it. We're not going to try to bluff you. But we're not going to put blinking lights around it. We're just going to disclose this for those of you who pay attention. We're going to point you to some things. Of course, you always got to make sure that they're not trying to point you away from things that are worse. But look at the MD&A. I wrote MD&As myself. I knew people, others in companies that wrote MD&As. There's an actually surprising level of honesty in them. They do, you know, they're not going to... We got pressure. There was always pressure. Say good stuff. Don't say horrible stuff. Don't be brutal. And of course, you don't. That's stupid to just go over the top with criticism of your own company's financial statement. But at the same time, most of the people that I dealt with, they were straight up. They loved doing the MD&A. That's what I'm teaching you to do in this class. And it was like, oh, we get to actually analyze financial statements, and there are our own financial statements. So there was oftentimes a level of honesty that was kind of surprising in the MD&A. So read it. It's kind of dry, but it's not as bad as it used to be. The last thing I'll do before I cut some numbers with you here, or at least cut some concepts and numbers with you here. I had been doing consulting I helped companies go public and become public. Small companies, almost always. Most of them were destined to die, most of them, and in some cases the people in them were the most dishonest bastards on earth. They usually got by with what they did. The honest people who made mistakes, they were the ones who were more likely to go to prison. And that's what I saw in some cases. But in my time, one of the big hot issues during my time in the business was the plain language movement. It had been going through legal circles, and it had a faddish following, and it got into the conversation at the SEC. Documents that are filed, prospectuses, registration statements in general, K's, Q's, MD&As, they should be in plain language. Not legalese. They should be in normal language. Well, okay, from my perspective, there go my boilerplates out the window. All my legalese and my just copy-paste back in the days when we used WordPerfect and all that. That would shoot all that out the window. I'd actually have to talk in plain language. That was not why I opposed it and why I went on record with a comment to the SEC during the comment period on the plain language rules. I went on record opposing plain language. My argument was, aside from the fact that it was going to make me actually have to work for a living instead of just copy and paste stuff, my big concern was that plain language invites idiots to the table. When I use legalese, oftentimes my goal is to chase away people from Decatur, from Toledo, from Wheeling. I'm trying to get them out of my circle. I don't want those kinds of hillbillies investing in my stuff. That's the reality of it. Because I can guarantee you that I have some Joe. I read this and I can understand it, so I'm going to invest in this. 6 months later, when the stock is tanking, which it probably will in a normal company, it's going to go up and down, that fool is on the phone. I want to talk to the president of the company. I've lost my investment. Oh, shut up. Sit down. Buy and hold. Haven't you ever heard of that? You see, there has to be a certain separation so that if an investor like that wants to invest in the stock market, he does it through professionals and mutual funds, not directly into stocks of companies. That was why I opposed plain language. Of course, my opposition and that of others in the business was shot down. We now have plain language, friendly documents. They chat to you. Be careful of chatty language, because sometimes chatty language is very, very useful for bullshit. Down to the numbers. Or at least to the concepts that will generate the numbers. Look, I am not going to teach you accounting. I assume you know accounting from your accounting course. What you didn't purge out of your mind in a drunken binge as soon as the semester was over. If you need to know accounting, whatever you need to know of accounting, you probably already do for finance, but I do want to remind you of it just to make sure we're on the same page. Again, I'm not going to teach you how to do debits and credits, trial balances, and all of that kind of stuff. Quite personally, it drove me crazy. One of my grad school accounting teachers, he actually joked once. He said, if you cannot get the fee to match, you just try adding the page number. Do anything. It gets that rough sometimes when you're trying to do financial statements, the matching principle. However, the book makes a very good point. Accounting is probably the basis of civilization. We know for a fact that the first writing was accounting. The cuneiform, those little wedges you see that are the first ancient script, all that was done for was to keep accounts. In the early Renaissance, there was a monk named Pacioli who was actually the creator of the double-entry accounting system, which is the triumph of accounting and everything that came after it in terms of keeping records in a good order. So, yeah, God knows, as much disrespect as I give to accounting, it certainly does have a claim to being the basis of all civilization, which is sort of scary. You have revenue. Now, as I go through this, I'm going to be commenting on the issues that finance people have with what's going on here. Revenue would be your sales, maybe. The truth of the matter is, though, that not all sales are money. And again, notice how I keep my focus on cash here. Revenue is not the same as money, because there are what we call accounts receivable. That's in a lot of businesses, you can sell something, but you don't get the money for it right away. That's actually very normal in businesses, especially businesses that deal with the government, public sector, with other big businesses. You just put in your order, and then once you ship it, we'll get it, and then we'll pay you in a certain period of time. That's the way we do it. I had a company I was dealing with out of Australia, and they were just absolutely appalled. No, we're not sending you anything until you send us a check. Well, that's not how we do it. I was dealing with university with a school for this. No, you send us and then we cut you a check. And they are you crazy? We're not sending you anything until. So there was a little bit of a cultural difference there. Yeah, revenue can be generated without cash. So that's the first thing we have to watch out for. Now, cost of goods sold comes next. You will not see cost of goods sold on all financial statements. The cost of goods sold represents costs that can be in some way matched to revenues generated. Thing for thing. I sold something. This is what it cost to build that thing. So that would be in the cost of goods sold. However, not all things have something that you can intimately associate. Remember you wanted to start that massage parlor? Was that you? I don't know. I can't remember who it was. But, I mean, there you'd have revenue, but you wouldn't have really a cost of goods sold. There wasn't a thing of value that had been burned up to create the revenue that was generated. So there wouldn't be in a service business that cost of goods sold like there would be in a manufacturing business. So you might not see the cost of goods sold line. If you do, revenue less cost becomes gross profit. Your gross profit. What we would call your operating income. Your operating income. Essentially, the money that would be there to pay for the operations after you paid for the goods. Yeah.
Is overhead not in cost of goods sold?
Oh, it is. It is. Some overhead is. I have to be careful. I can't go too far because the rules are nuanced. The best way that I should do it is just to stick to the idea that you have to be able to show that cost of goods sold in some way is related clearly to the revenue generated. Like, for example, your salary, your wages might not be, because they could be very diffuse, what you do as a manager of the company. A light bill might not be really part of it, because I can't associate the lights being turned on with what product was sold or how much was sold of the unit. Clearly, if the lights are off, I won't be able to sell much of the product unless it's glow-in-the-dark watches. But at the same time, how do I measure? Well, we used 400 kilowatts of electricity, so that was associated with 18 of our units sold. So you're right, some overhead is. But it's a little nuanced. The way we look at it in finance, is what you see in cost of goods sold, I can in some way intimately match to what was sold. And that's why we marry those two up and separate them so we get to this operating income line. And then from there, we have two. From the gross profit, we will deduct selling and administrative expenses. Now, these can get extraordinarily detailed. Yes, sometimes we will dig in as financial analysts and look line by line by line, especially those of us who are more of an OCD type. We will just pick them apart. But in general, we see the selling and administrative expenses broadly separated. And again, here, not all of this is going to be cash out of the pocket. You work for me for $5 an hour. And you work 40 hours this week, and I'm going to, obviously, at the end of the week, you've earned $200. I'm not going to pay you. You have to stay here until, you have to work another week before I'll pay you, obviously. So I've incurred $200, which I'm going to put down right away. But it did not occur. No $200 came out of my pocket. A week from now, yeah, I'll pay you. And then I'll be able to clean up the financial statement on the balance sheet side. I'll deal with what's an accrued expense. But for right now, that would say $200 I've spent, which I haven't, you see. So again, I caution, when you look at the financial statements themselves, that's not cash. Now, here is the ultimate in not cash. It is depreciation. Depreciation. There is no such thing. No one has ever written a check paid to the order of depreciation. I had a professor once who said he'd like to change his name to depreciation so people really could pay someone depreciation. It's not going to happen. Depreciation doesn't exist as a cash flow. No cash disappears. You can have a depreciation of $1 million. No $1 million went out the door because of depreciation. Depreciation is an accounting concept. There is an economic concept of depreciation, which is very fuzzy, which I won't get into. But in accounting, this depreciation line, that's just a rule-based system to recognize in an orderly fashion the use of an asset matching up to the way it was generating revenue. Depreciation doesn't exist, so we're going to have to add that back in to do any kind of serious cash analysis. And once you've gotten these done, you've got your earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT, EBIT. Now, the thing about it is, and I'm sorry, I said operating income up there. I do apologize. Gross profit is not. EBIT is what we call operating income. I don't know what I'm thinking. Operating income is EBIT. Now, interestingly, and I'm not sure, this is a ritual. I know an executive out here, he's a finance jockey. He is obsessed with this animal called EBITDA, E-B-I-T-D-A, E-B-I-T-D-A, where you add back depreciation and amortization. Amortization is kind of like a type of depreciation for intangibles. But it works like depreciation. It's got its own rules. There's no actual cash going out. But what EBITDA does is it takes EBIT, your operating income, and just adds back in your depreciation and amortization, those non-cash items. And I've met other financial people who are just really interested in EBITDA. And I'm not sure why. Because, you know, really, yeah, you're adding back in things that were taken out that didn't represent true cash. But hell, you got so much other stuff on that financial statement already by the time you get to the operating income line that's non-cash. Sometimes you're worrying about depreciation and amortization when you're not recognizing the fact that the stupid revenue is all on accounts receivable and the company's going to go bankrupt soon. Go into insolvency, I should say. You see, but I do caution, you might get involved in a company where you hear EBITDA all the time, or EBITDA, or however they want to pronounce it. It's something interesting, but I mean, geez, if you're going to sweat about non-cash items like depreciation and amortization, you better start sweating about these items farther up the line that might not be cash flowing in or flowing out too. So there you are. Okay, now interest. You take out the interest and you get the EBT line. But here's the deal again. Just because you have incurred an interest expense on debt does not mean that the cash outflow has occurred. In fact, I can have interest due on my bonds and I'll recognize it. Oh yeah, right away, I had interest due of $800,000, so take that off there. I haven't cut the checks. I won't cut the checks until next month. So there it is on the financial statement, spent that money, but the cash is still in the bank. As a matter of fact, my job is to see how long I can keep cash without paying a bill. Personally, I shouldn't say that for finance. 5 years. I've been working on one bill for 5 years. Yeah, uh-huh. But, I mean, this is just the reality of it. These numbers are telling us, yes, in theory, ideally, this is what has already happened. But in practice, a lot of this stuff, the money is still there. We paid that interest. Next month, we'll send the checks out. But they are in the mail. Okay, now you take your tax off. I was watching something there. I think I'll hold off here until the next time to talk about marginal tax rates. But here, yeah. Anyway, EBIT minus interest is earnings before taxes. Now, nothing complicated there. And then you take away your taxes, and you get down to your net income. And don't call it net profit. I mean, that's so gross. You don't say profit. Profit's a dirty word. It's net income. Okay. But this tax line, I was almost tempted to go into that, but I think I want to wait until the next class to talk about the tax part of it. Because taxes, we are in a progressive tax system in this country. Higher blocks of income are taxed at a higher percentage than lower blocks of income are. That's true of personal income. That's true of corporate income. Now, the book has the table, tax tables for 2005. I would caution you that there were some really heavy tax cuts done in 2001. And they were supposed to sunset in just a couple of years. A lot of them are. And so the tax rates will be going up on their own in a couple of years. And that's going to be political hell, war, because there will be claims, well, they're raising taxes on us. No, they're going back to the level that they were before the tax cuts of 2001. But then you'll probably also see higher taxes anyway, just in a desperate attempt to try to start closing the budget deficits. So the textbook has the marginal tax rates as of 2005, which are pretty much in play right now, the same ones. But those will be changing soon enough. So the whole name of the game, of course, in accounting is a very real effect, is to have expenses up here that don't hurt, but they do reduce your earnings exposed to taxation, your taxable income. So that's a game just for people to play. It's a game for corporations to play. We all do it trying to find as much as we can to take away before we get to the line that actually is where we calculate tax. One way or t'other, this is where the financial statement called the income statement ends. Because what's going to happen here is that you're going to calculate, you're going to get your net income, and then you're going to subtract out any dividends that you paid. To get the amount that is contributed to retained earnings for the year. And I call that change in retained earnings. Change in retained earnings. That's, by the way, old symbology. I don't know if they even use it anymore. The R/E, the A/P. Do they still use that in account? Okay. You gotta forgive me. I come back from the time of Pacioli, so sometimes I use some notation that looks a little bit old these days. But here's the deal, because that's part of the balance sheet. That dude right there in the owner's equity section essentially there is the retained earnings at the beginning of the period, and then you'll do this little calculation right here, plus net income less dividends is your change in retained earnings for the period. And then you put those two together and you get your retained earnings for the end of the period. Change in retained earnings for the end of the period. Here's the deal though. And I've heard this. Well, we'll just finance this project out of retained earnings or something to that effect. There's no such thing in reality as retained earnings. There is no bank account called retained earnings. Retained earnings is nothing but a symbol. It represents the accumulation of our net incomes, net of dividends, since the company began. That's all it is. It does not mean that that money is there. It does not mean that there is any money anywhere in the company. You can have companies with massive retained earnings that die. Similarly, you can have companies that have thin retained earnings that are just chugging right along. Retained earnings is not a money account, because retained earnings comes from this blend of money and non-money stuff that's done largely for tax purposes, largely to maintain the rule base of the accounting system. But it is not real stuff. Okay, now, let me hit the balance sheet here. The balance sheet is actually pretty straightforward for what we do in finance. The balance sheet. Here's the deal. We break things up into the currents and the long terms. And on the asset side, and then there's, of course, the liability side. And then here in the long term, there's the assets and the liabilities. Now, really, in the asset side, all what we're doing with the currents is we're looking at things that are going to come to us or go from us within about a year, within the year. Okay, that's the quickest way to talk about it. We are talking about liquidity here. In the current section, we are talking about things that have greater or lesser degrees of liquidity. We can change them into other things, hopefully cash. So in the asset, current asset side, of course, is your cash, which is a happy thing to have. You also will have marketable securities. And by marketable securities, I might be talking about things like mutual fund accounts, money market mutual fund accounts, things like that. Things that could be very quickly turned into cash money. You would also have, of course, your accounts receivable would be there too, because those should, you hope to hell, those things will be money within the year. And then you also have your inventory, which you hope that it's going to be converted into a sale somewhere in the year. Certainly if it's perishable goods, you would hope for that. I don't know, though. Something like beef jerky, maybe you could have inventory of that for years. And then prepaid expenses. That's things like insurance. You pay your insurance for the year at the beginning of the year. So if I paid $12,000 at the beginning of the year, in February, I would look at that financial statement and I would say, oh, there's $11,000 in prepaid expenses. Well, you said $12,000. Yeah, because I carried $1,000 over to the income statement. I expensed out $1,000 of it. So I still have sort of like this asset, you owe me. In a sense, I could say, well, if I really got desperate, I could go to the insurance agent and beat him up and get my money back for the rest of the year. So that's why that's really an asset. I've prepaid it, and now I can just recognize it. And as the bill comes due, I can move it over here to the expenses as the year goes along. Okay, now on the liability side, cash, marketable securities, and account receivable, inventory, prepaid expenses. Cash and marketable securities are, of course, your biggies. And, of course, in cash, you might even have a petty cash. A company I work for, I really love this company. Its petty cash was always, or they try to keep petty cash at around $2,000, which was just excellent. Steaks are expensive in Houston. God bless those oil men. But that's another story entirely. Look, on the liabilities, current liability side, you have your, of course, your accounts payable. On my personal financial statements, the accounts payable is rather large, but that's another story. Now remember that you could have actually expensed those somewhere in here. Some of that could be have been up in here somewhere, but over here, the bill was incurred, but it did not occur. So I could have something occur here and here, a bill, $1,000. Yeah, I can recognize it, but I haven't paid it. Once I pay it, it goes out of here, and that drops that down. Just some simple accounting. And I'm trying to be deliberately lightweight with this. Okay, another one that is on here is notes payable. And I know I already said bills are short term, notes are intermediate term, and bonds are long term. But in accounting, you would say notes payable, describing your IOUs and your short promissory instruments. Briefly, I've got to go through something here in just a minute. But also on this side is your accruals, your accrued expenses, I should say. These are things like I owed you that money. So what I would do is I'd recognize your $200 as a wage expense. And I put it over here, and then when I paid you, I would match it off like that. Now, here's the thing, though. Interestingly enough, and I just bring this up sort of as a quick sidebar item, is that in these current assets and current liabilities, we're talking about the difference between the currents as being working capital. Now, working capital management is a science of its own, and I'm going to try to just touch it a little bit in this class. There's some math to it. Thank God for spreadsheets these days, because the math always kind of fogged me, too, sometimes. But here's what working capital management is all about. For many companies, their revenue is almost all during a couple of months, the Christmas season. That's the way they live, is essentially through the year, they're starving, and then they do great at Christmas. Or at least we hope to God we do well at Christmas, because otherwise we're dead. But in the old days, and this has been true up until very recently, essentially you worked out, you kept really good records, and you created sort of this understanding of the cycle of your, when you really didn't have any money, and then when you were swimming in money. And then you would go to a bank, a commercial bank, and you would say, okay, look, this is the part of the year where I don't have money. This is the part of the year when I'm drowning in it. And what the bank would do with you is set up cash management system, so that you were essentially, they would set up a line of credit. During the year, your company would draw on this line of credit. Literally, for many of you, if you've worked in retail, you might have been paid on borrowed money. Essentially, the company borrows money through the year to pay its bills, and then during the big boom season at Christmas time, that's when the company pays off the line of credit, and then it just starts the whole process over again the next year. And that way, the company does great, the bank makes money on the interest, and the manufacturers up the line, they are okay because they've got retailers to sell their stuff. Works beautifully. It's a science of calculating how much you're going to need for your line of credit and all that. Here's the problem, though. When the credit markets froze up, there were a whole lot of banks just said, screw you. They just stopped doing the working capital management two-step with businesses. The businesses just went under right there. Boom. And that's why some of these bankruptcies that you saw, it was just because the bank just said, no, we aren't going to do it anymore. Sorry. And so you see this thing in the paper about, well, these companies were poorly managed and all this blah, blah, blah. Horse crap. A lot of these companies have just been doing the same thing year over year. They stepped up to the plate for the usual working capital management deal. Bank said, we're not doing anymore. Bite me. And there's companies that say, what? Are you nuts? Think about other companies, like companies that do floor planning. My brother was a boat dealer, and he was destroyed because of a similar thing that happened back many, many years ago. Every year, boat companies, furniture companies, companies that have seasonal merchandise that's very big ticket, and they put it all on their showroom floor, they get a big loan. They put all this stuff on the floor, and then people come and they buy it. And then the company can then pay off the loan that it used the floor plan. Think what happens when the bank says, we're not doing that anymore. Credit markets are frozen. Go find someone else to do it. Sorry, bye. These companies were just, boom, right there, they were gone. Because that's how you do it. You borrow the money to put all the furniture on your showroom floor, and then you sell that furniture over a period of months, and you pay back the loan. If the bank isn't going to do that, play the game anymore, you're out of business instantly. You've never built up a pad, a cash reserve to buy your own, to floor plan, self-finance floor planning. So be cautious when you hear about all these criticisms of companies that just weren't properly managed. Crap, a lot of that was just these companies were screwed over when the credit markets froze up. Now, on Thursday, I will go through an example using financial statements. And that's all I have for you today. I thank you.